Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Well, the elections are finally over, and as promised, we have some great guests to analyze it and to see where we go from here. Our guests are Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. He is the editor of the Black Agenda Report, and Deborah Sweet, who is the National Director of World Can't Wait. Plus, we have phone calls from our listeners. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Forward. Where do we go from here?
Welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, Glenn Ford. It's great to have you on.
It's good to be here. I could figure out some better days to be here, but this is a movie that we've already seen. And so although we're not looking forward to the next 4 years, I'm not filled with dread about it, because I think we know what we can expect. Barack Obama will be unimpeded, as he was for these past 4 years, by any really significant resistance from his left. And that means that he can do what he wants to do. What does he want to do? He wants that grand bargain with the Republicans. He's been looking for it since he decided to run for president, but certainly he's been asking for it since before he took the oath of office. The age of austerity began with President Obama. It, in fact, began 2 weeks before President Obama was sworn in, when he told the press conference, volunteered the information during his watch, all entitlements, including Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare, would be on the table for chopping. The Republicans did not put him in that position. The Republicans were on their ass, just as they are on their ass today. The punditry were speaking back in January of 2009 about it being questionable that the Republican Party had a future, just as they are saying today. The Republicans were in no shape to impose or insist upon an austerity regime. The Social Security was untouchable in 2009. George Bush had tried to touch it, and he suffered his most serious domestic defeat when he tried to tamper with Social Security. So this debate about austerity begins with that press conference with President Obama agreeing with the Republicans that the budget deficit is the main problem that the country faces. And he followed through methodically, appointing this deficit reduction commission, heavily weighted to the right, with a right-wing Republican and a right-wing Democrat in charge. And its very composition dictated that the result would be a blueprint for austerity. And that's what he got. The Republicans didn't force him to do that. They didn't have the clout to force him to do that. He did that when before the Republicans had control of the House. They were in no shape to impose this kind of austerity conversation. He did it. He was ready to cave to the Republicans, or rather, in fact, that's not a very good word. He was ready to make his grand bargain with the Republicans in the summer of 2011. The $4 trillion cuts that had come out of his deficit reduction commission, that was a figure that the Republican leadership was discussing at that time. And the only thing that stopped them having this grand bargain around $4 trillion in cuts, most of it, of course, to domestic programs. The only thing that stopped it was that the Republicans balked at even modest tax increases on the rich. Otherwise, this was good to go. And now we hear from the Republican leadership that they will entertain some modest increases in taxes for the rich. And it looks like this grand bargain will be achieved possibly within days. Certainly it will be achieved in this lame duck Congress. And yet, we have these people who call themselves progressives who believe that they won something on Tuesday. What could they have possibly won when they did not even demand anything of this man?
Right.
How can you win something when the guy who is elected has not adopted even one element of your program? What did you win?
Well, and today, I don't know if you wrote it today or yesterday, but posted at the Black Agenda Report at your blog, you said that the so-called left African-American community has made themselves irrelevant in political discourse. What did you mean when you said that?
If you make no demands or make no suggestions even to a candidate, then that candidate has no obligation to respond to you, there is nothing to respond about. So this is the second election in a row. And the only two that I am aware of, certainly not in my conscious lifetime, in which Black America has made not one demand of the Democratic presidential candidate. If you don't make a demand, then your political wishes are of course automatically not reflected in the candidate's own platform. That makes you irrelevant. If the party or the candidate can count on your vote regardless of the political behavior of that candidate or party, then certainly you are irrelevant. You are irrelevant to their behavior. But what I'm talking about here is a political community that has forgotten how to be political. It has not only forgotten how to do activist and independent Black politics, it doesn't even understand how to play the Democratic political game. It doesn't know how to play the game of bourgeois politics. It was and remains afraid to even open its mouth in fear that whatever it expresses might be understood in some way as embarrassing the first Black president. And so not only do they not make demands or even strong suggestions about policy, they seem to be afraid to even advance a general Black conversation about the future of Black folks and the future of the country. They have become actually mute in a substantive sense. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It is as if the president's presence of a Black man in the White House has short-circuited every political instinct in Black America.
Well, of course, that could also be said for other movements, you know, such as the labor movement or the environmental movement or the anti-war movement. They kind of make these demands, but they say, but don't worry, we're still going to vote for you. So, of course, that renders those movements irrelevant also. So are they rendering themselves irrelevant? Is the empire doing it? Is the Democratic president doing it? Where do we go from here?
Oh, sure, they're rendering themselves irrelevant. Now, however, making a comparison between the behavior of white folks who are left or should be on the left and the behavior of Black folks in the presence of a Black president is a stretch. The behavior may seem the same, but it's coming from a rather different place. But yeah, to directly answer your question, yeah, the whole of the Democratic Party base has made itself irrelevant by not effectively forcing this president to at least even pay lip service to its concerns.
Well, what do we do? I sent out an email blast to my supporters who have definitely waned since Barack Obama's been president. I have a very small list right now. But I said, are we finally going to hold the cloven hooves of empire to the fire of peace and justice? Or do you think, in your analysis, that the Democratic base will still be silent for fear of electing a Republican in 2016?
Well, I do believe that the white part of the base is more likely to shake loose these silly fears than the black part of the base. I actually, to be quite frank, don't believe we're going to see any renaissance of politics of any kind, except that of fawning and fan and worshipness in black America until this president is gone. But I can't speak about white left behavior. After all, the Occupy movement was basically a white left affair, and it did have an impact on the conversation, at least for, about a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so are you ready to take some questions from the callers?
Sure.
Okay, what happens is they email me the questions beforehand, and if they're on the call, I'll ask them to unmute themselves so they can directly have a dialogue with you. If they're not on the call, then I will have to ask you their question. But the first question is from Elizabeth Cook. Elizabeth, if you're on the call, can you press star 6 to unmute yourself to ask Glenn Ford your question?
Yes, hi, thank you.
Are you there, Elizabeth? Okay, great.
Yes, I am.
Okay, awesome. So go ahead.
With my question? Okay.
Yes.
Well, what I remember, I think, is it seems to me that one of the, I guess, antidotes to where we are is community building in terms of opposition and dissent. Here in Louisiana, as you know, we've been faced with first Katrina, then Rita, then the BP oil disaster, but also coming to light are environmental disasters after Isaac. And from my vantage point, the only solution that I can come up with is to go community by community, re-educating folks as to inalienable rights in terms of the right to clean air, water, and soil, and that these rights have to be defended or we're going to lose them, because these communities are losing these rights even as we speak. So I guess I'm posing that as a just something to discuss. Maybe not really a question, just a point of discussion, and ask Glenn what he thinks of building dissent community by community.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. What we have to acknowledge, and this I guess applies to white left, but it certainly applies to black America, is the need to build a new leadership and stop trying to deal with these same old tired cards that we've had to play with and that don't work, and that of course means rekindling and kindling local community movements that will incubate a new kind of leadership at the local level. Forget about, at least in black America, forget about the national leadership. They're just albatrosses that'll hold us back, and see if we can get some new blood and some new thinking going. There is nothing that's going to resuscitate the black movement except a rebuilding of a black political consciousness from the ground up. And the reason I keep on referring to the black movement is I don't believe that we're going to have a vibrant progressive movement in the United States while Black America is politically comatose, that hasn't been the model for the last 40 or 50 years. I believe that had Black folks not been politically comatose in this past year, that the Occupy movement would have had more vitality and staying power as well.
Okay, thank you, Glenn, and thank you, Elizabeth. I put you back on mute so we can go with the next question. This question actually didn't have a name, so I'm going to ask you this question. And Deborah, I'd like you to kind of make note of these so you can comment on them from after the bottom of the hour when Glenn has to leave us. But Glenn, I got a question. I don't even know who it was from. But it says, the progressive anti-war representation in the House and Senate has been strengthened, I guess they meant after this past election, though still very much a minority. How can the peace movement support them and help them grow? So from you, I'd like to, you know, add an addendum to that question. Do you think the addition of someone like Alan Grayson or Elizabeth Warren to the House and Senate actually did strengthen the anti-war community in the House and Senate? And is it our job to help them grow?
No, and in fact, getting a fixation on those few hopeful faces in the U.S. national legislature is exactly the wrong way to go. The way that you influence and support those new hopeful faces is to build a bigger and more effective grassroots movement. And the way you influence those faces that we've gotten tired of looking at and have become tired is to build a movement. So, yeah, we should not, and I think it's always been really a big mistake, we should not focus our attentions and even pile too much baggage on those few progressive voices that still exist. The real job is to build a movement, and that's the best thing you can do for them, and not load them down with all of our demands, and expect them to carry demands that we can't get 50,000 people in the street to vocalize.
Well, also, I mean, just to talk about those two people in particular, Elizabeth Warren supports sanctions against Iran and, you know, further action to keep Iran from getting a nuke, supposedly. And Alan Grayson is also very pro-Israeli policy. So, you know, I don't think that even their people that we, as anti-war people, should, you know, even think about aligning with myself.
Oh, that's right, but there is a whole wing of folk who claim to be progressive who support so-called humanitarian intervention, which is waging war against international law and peace by its very nature. How do you fight them? You fight them at the level of the street as well. We can't make any impression on the national legislature or even folk who seem that they are open to the argument unless the argument is emanating from lots of marching feet in the street. Now, there is no magic wand. Our inability to effectuate that is disappointing, but it doesn't mean that's not the tried and true route. There's no substitute, and we shouldn't pin our hopes on a couple of nice sounding folks who have somehow found their way into this bankers dominated Congress.
Exactly. Okay, so we just have like 10 more minutes with you. So I'd like to move on to if Sandy Fessler from Rochester is on the call. Sandy, can you unmute yourself by going star 6 and ask the question that you submitted for Glenn? And we'll give you a few seconds. If you don't appear, I will ask the question. Okay. Sandy is from Rochester, and he or she, I don't know if it's a male or female.
Sandy's a good person. We know Sandy.
Oh, okay. And Sandy, did you say is a man?
Is a woman.
Oh, a woman. I probably know her, too. In fact, I probably do. She says that the drone protests that she does in Rochester the day after election had only 2 people, when they usually have 20 or 30. But her question is, do you think online petitions directed at Obama, Eric Holder, and others have any value?
Well, they certainly don't have any effect on them unless these petitions come in the form of hundreds of thousands. I think the online petitions are really designed to start a conversation among the audience of like-minded people, and that's a good thing to do. But you know, an online petition that gets 20,000 people's signatures isn't as valuable as a march that includes 200 people. And of course, as I said, they don't have any effect on these officials, on the enemy, if you're talking about Holder and such. Unless they're backed up by numbers that potentially threaten their power or their ability to exercise that power unfettered.
I'm going to ask Diane G. I unmuted you, and you have a question. But before you ask your question, Diane, I'd like to ask Glenn, what do you think about the scuttlebutt that Hillary Clinton, Timothy Geithner, and Eric Holder may in fact be leaving the administration for the next term?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yeah, it's for you, Glenn.
Oh.
Sorry.
Okay. I don't think anything about it. These people are interchangeable. What is the difference between an Eric Holder and whoever replaces him, except possibly some kind of signal to one wing of the cabal or the other? What is the difference between Hillary Clinton and any other?
Lisa, for example.
Excuse me.
And what was the difference between Hillary and Condoleezza Rice?
Or Susan Rice.
Exactly.
Who is much more likely. She's who the folks are talking about. If it's going to be between Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice, I'd prefer that Hillary Clinton stay, I suppose, so that black folks wouldn't have another black face in high places to mesmerize themselves and further neutralize them on in the area of foreign policy. But of course I know that there would be no substantive difference between Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton.
Glenn.
But if you're asking my brothers, yeah, I'd rather see no more black faces in high places fronting for imperialism and Wall Street. My folks are already too confused by that.
Great. So I think we have time for one more question with you, Glenn. And, of course, we really appreciate your time with us. Can you tell everybody your email? I know you put it on your blog, but there were other questions that people had, but we're not going to have time for them. So perhaps they could email you?
Yeah, and if folks lose it, like I said, it's on attached to every article that I write. It's Glenn with one N. Ford@blackagendareport.com, and Black Agenda Report is at www.blackagendareport.com. Comes out every Wednesday.
Okay, great. My partner Diane G, partner in crime, is on the line, and I'm going to ask her to ask you the question that she had for you, which I thought was a very good question.
I've changed it. Cindy, Glenn, thanks for having me. Well, no, Glenn, I'm a huge fan. I've been reading you throughout, well, I've been reading for a long time, but more avidly throughout this campaign. And you've really made the case for a more effective evil. But it never struck home for me today, like it did when I read you and listened to you speak just now, about how effective it has been to the Black community. And I'm going to frame it in terms of, I'm a socialist. And the face of capitalism, the face of predation, has been white. Even what was, I went to Occupy in Detroit, and it was white people running it, and they lost the Black community. They lost all people of color. So here, you know, they kept America, white America, alive with this John Wayne, if you try hard, you too can be one of us, image, voting against their own interests. And Black people historically voted for a more sane and socialist type of world, good for everyone. Do you think that part of Barack Obama's elevation has now given them that false American dream? Because, you know, here's the epitome, they're still worshiping capitalism. Well, one of us done good and became one of them, like they do to, they've historically done to us to keep us cheaple.
It is very difficult to believe that 4 years of Barack Obama has changed the basic political character, the world view of Black America. That just does not seem to compute on any social science basis. What it has done is, well, let me put it this way. Black people are not smarter than white people. But our political advantage, that which has allowed us to see the world better than white people in the United States, is the skepticism of power that history has driven into us. However, with the advent of the first Black president, we then identify with that particular person in the White House, and our skepticism of power, our reflexive distrust of what the man is doing, becomes short-circuited. And without that defense, well, we don't seem to have any moorings whatsoever. Now, will that is that going to lead to some kind of permanent damage to the Black worldview? I can't see how that happens. And here's an example that I like to give. In February of 2003, it was less than a month before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and everybody knew the U.S. was going to invade Iraq. And the Zogby polling organization asked the question, this is almost exactly how it went. Would you support an invasion of Iraq if it would result in the death of thousands of Iraqi civilians? In fact, that's the exact wording of the question. 70% or so of white males said yes, they would support the invasion even if it resulted in thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians being killed. A little over a majority of white women said they would support such an invasion, and a little less than a majority of Hispanics said they also would support an invasion under those circumstances. Only 7% of Black Americans answered in the affirmative to that Zogby question. And that shows how large how far apart the Black worldview on U.S. Aggressive wars and imperial wars is from not just the white view, but also from the Hispanic worldview. It's a gaping chasm, and I don't see how 4 years of Barack Obama will significantly shrink that. What really bothers me, as we now look at 8 years of Obama, is what it does to young Black folks who are just coming into consciousness and have no role models for resistance whatsoever. That is, they do not see Black adults their older relatives and older folks in their community speaking truth to power. They don't see examples of skepticism of those who wield power. And I don't know what effect that's going to have on that young generation. 8 years is about the length of time, duration of that period that we loosely call the 60s, which usually in most folks' minds means 1963 to about 1971, about 8 years. Now we're going to have, and those 8 years produced a generation that whose worldview included the assumption that it is right to resist. I don't know what 8 years of Barack Obama and this neutralizing of the black community, this lack of any political resistance. I don't know what kind of young person that creates, but that really, that does bother me. That would be the beginning of a possible change in the black worldview, starting with some very young people.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much for the Black Agenda Report, and you and Bruce Dixon and Margaret Kimberly hopefully can be that leadership for the young black people. And I know you mean a lot to all of us, and not just the black community, for being so consistent with your integrity and with your truth. I know it has meant a lot to me.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me and allowing me to be in your presence this evening.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll talk to you soon, Glenn Ford. Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I know that you have a lot to do, so thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good evening.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to get to everybody's question, but now we're going to welcome Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait to the show. And Deborah, before you come on, I have a request from our friend there in New York City, Sally Elcordy. She has asked me to announce an event on Sunday, November 11th at 3 p.m. It's called Chins Up in New York. It's raising fund and food for Hurricane Sandy victims. And there's an event page on Facebook, and it's I can't see where it's going to be. But go to Chins Up New York, raising fund and food for Hurricane Sandy at 3 o'clock, November 11th. So go to the Facebook page for more information about that, Sally, or in case you want to actually tell me where it's going to be so I can tell. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. It's going to be at 244 West 54th Street on the 10th floor, Studio 1. So that's 244 West 54th Street, 10th floor, Studio 1, 3 p.m. on Sunday in New York City, raising fund and food for Hurricane Sandy relief. So, Deborah, do you have a statement, and do you want to comment on the questions that Glenn was asked?
I do. You know.
Hi, Deborah. Thank you. Deborah Sweet, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Cindy, you were here, and you escaped New York on the day Sandy was coming in.
I did. Yay.
we were about to have a good time, but what's up to Elizabeth and Sandy Fessler, my running buddies, and whoever else is on the call. I have so much to say, and you know, World Can't Wait's going to be saying a lot of it on our website and our emails in the next few weeks. I feel bound to dig in and challenge my brother Glenn Ford on his statement that I feel is just way too pessimistic on the side of the people's things when he says he feels there will be, how did he put it? there will be that Barack Obama will be unimpeded by any really significant resistance from the left. You know, I have to say, God damn it, not if we have anything to say about it.
Well, we have been working for a long, long time, but I think the key there is significant. Were we able to get a significant resistance to the policies of Obama over the last 4 years?
Well, no.
Besides the Occupy movement.
No,
yeah.
The Democrats came to power, and they paralyzed the movement for the most part. Not the people on this call, at least the ones that I know, were never paralyzed and didn't have the same level of illusions that a lot of people have had. But, you know, thinking back to 2008, you told this story the other night in New York when you spoke at Revolution Books about losing half of your mailing list 3 days after Obama's inauguration when you criticized him. In fact, you called him a war criminal. Because he did a drone strike in Pakistan. What did he do after his re-election? He just did a drone strike in Yemen.
Right.
Right? And this is a whole picture here of the unbridled, whether it's Republican or Democrat, they have complete unity on the importance of the national security state, up and down, U.S. domination being expressed militarily, financially, and even ideologically all over the world. With anyway, everybody on the call knows this, so I feel it's essential to say absolutely there has not been significant. There wasn't even enough resistance when Bush was in, for God's sakes. Otherwise, we would have driven him out.
Right.
I mean, forgive me, and I am not a Pollyanna person.
Uh-huh.
But I am not about to lay down in the face of this horror of the U.S. continuing to do what it does, even in the United States. And I've got to say that when Glenn is talking about there won't be enough significant resistance coming from the black community, you know, we all have to take into account that there's an epidemic of mass incarceration that most completely and specifically affects the black community, the Latino community, oppressed communities across the country are people who are affected by this. It is so bad that in New York City, 2,000 people get stopped every day for illegal searches. You know, illegal under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, where NYPD says, you know, basically we're holding you and we're looking through all your stuff, and you're not free to go until we're through with you. This is what's developed. It's the new face of Jim Crow. It's the new face, really, of slavery in this society. And all of those things that this system is doing were never addressed in this election, and they're not going to even be talked about. But they are the very things that are happening to people that I believe have the potential to create very significant resistance indeed to what this government is doing. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not going to give up on it. We don't know what the future is going to bring. And in a certain sense, I share some disappointment. I was kind of deflated the other night about 11:30 or 12. I'm looking around on Facebook, and people who are my friends, including many people I actually know, are saying things like, "We won."
Right.
You know, and I had to write to people. You were not saying that, Cindy. But I had to write to people and say, first of all, who's we? And what
uh-huh.
do you mean? What do you mean by won? The same thing Glenn just said. What was won? What was brought into being was a very powerful endorsement, unfortunately, of a lot of horrors being carried out in our name. Under and with the participation of a lot of people who, in some cases, I think, are willfully self-deluding themselves, that by electing Barack Obama, they're going to forestall or stand against some of the worst abuses of the freaking fanatics of the right wing. I don't know what the future is going to bring, but I do know, and you made this case really powerfully the other night in New York, that under the Democrats, reproductive rights for women took a bigger hit than even under the Republicans across the country.
And I was going to ask you about that, Deborah. I don't want to interrupt you, but it's the same question. Of course, I was attacked in the weeks leading up to the election because people were saying me running for vice president was going to hurt reproductive freedom of women here in the United States. And one of the biggest, pro-choice activists or advocates that I know. And what is your answer to that question? You were just getting started on answering that, but I want you to broaden your answer a little bit.
Well, I have been an activist for reproductive rights for the last 30-some years under Democrats and Republicans. And if you look at what happened when Democrats were in power, that's the Clinton administration over 8 years, that's when doctors were killed. You know, I think it was 9 people working in abortion clinics were killed. People can attribute that to the right wing becoming, you know, more angry and frustrated. And there's certainly a point to that. But the Democrats have approached the question, for the most part, of reproductive rights as we want to keep abortion and birth control safe, legal, and rare. And I always felt, you know, that they should be safe, legal, and well done, but that's an aside. That was a little joke. The point being that all of those rights are in our hands. We have to fight for that. We got abortion rights in the first place in 1973. Who was president? The Republican. It was a very conservative Supreme Court, and they had to give women this right because we were coming out of that period Glenn talked about, the 60s, when it was right to rebel and resist. And I'm arguing for not giving up and being determinist in the face of this situation where a lot of people are deluded. And even worse than that, people feel like there's not much that's ever going to change in some cases, or nothing really needs to change, or they feel paralyzed that anything really substantially can change. We've got to take on all of those things because they're not true. Just because things in this country are the way they are does not mean they have to stay this way. There are people, all of us and people we know, who have to really seriously buckle down, redouble our efforts, but also have some imagination about how things could be different and understand that no matter what the system does, their system is just going to keep working to generate people who are really exploited and oppressed. And out of that is always the potential for resistance, if not more than that. And frankly, you have a book about revolution right now. It's been one of your themes. I think that's certainly a question that everybody on this call and much more widely should be thinking about. Is this really the best that human society can do? Of course not. We know that. And I just want to encourage people on this call to, you know, I had my moment. I unfriended some people the other night. My criteria was, really, I did, and I never pay that much attention. There's a lot of good people. But my criteria was, if you got in my face on my Facebook page and said we won and you were all red, white, and blue about it, I had to send you a note and unfriend you for a while and say, when you come back to your senses, I'll be happy to, you know, have you on my page. But you are really doing some damage. You know, if you're promoting Barack Obama, the more, as Glenn says, the more effective evil, as I say, the willing commander-in-chief of slaughter of people across the world. I would never vote for a Democrat. You know, since I got deluded for a minute in 1972, I did vote for George McGovern. But ever since that, the Democrats have firmly stayed as the war party, and they should never deserve our support at any level.
Well, Deborah, you were an awesome addition to the call. I wanted you and I wanted Glenn because you both have been very consistently opposed to empire, no matter what form it takes, Democrat or Republican. You know, World Can't Wait, of course, is one of the organizations, the only ones left that I'm able to work with because you're actually doing something. So do you have any plans, anything that the callers can connect to?
Well, you know, Sandy Fessler from is the proud owner of a model drone in Rochester.
Uh-huh.
And that's the reason I know her, because we've been out literally, you know, toting that sucker around and engaging in these protests of drones. Why is it? Because drones as a particular form are worse than any other form of mass warfare? No. But they've become symbolic of Obama, actually.
Right.
Our own president. And it is remarkable. My heart breaks for Sandy going out with only two people the day after the election. That's where we are. I have been there, exactly in the same place. This is what we're facing. But the fact is, he's going to use drones more and more. He now is allegedly, and I'm speaking of Obama as the president, which is not about Obama as the person, but Obama as the commander-in-chief of the biggest military in world history, willingly, you know, wielding this across the world. This is going to spread. The drone war is now spreading into Africa. We understand drones have been used by the U.S. in the Philippines, so you're talking now about several continents. This opposition to the drone war really is a very important opposition to the whole rampaging so-called war on terror that the U.S. is continuing. And I do feel that that is the most important issue that we cannot let up on. And so I would call on people to be thinking about, as we head into whatever the next war is, but even immediately, we've partnered up with the No Drones Project. We're actually getting a drone in the next couple weeks out to the Bay Area, Cindy. So you
cool.
too can appear with the drone model.
Uh-huh.
But we're taking this to the people as we've always done. Our We Are Not Your Soldiers project is sending, and you've been out on it with us, sending Iraq and Afghanistan veterans into high schools is extremely important. We've got to intercept this flow of young people into the military because, you know, they lose their humanity and they take the humanity of so many other people. This war in Afghanistan is not over. They're going to special forces. They're going to different kind of weapons. But they're committed there till 2024, 12 more years. Oh,
my grandchildren just came over. No, it started, but I'm going to go in the other room. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Deborah. Sorry about that.
You know, and I will say that I think there's many important things people are doing. I wanted to speak to Elizabeth because this is something we've talked about, and I've been in New Orleans with Elizabeth just a little bit, and I know the important work that she just is indefatigable about is the environmental destruction and the human destruction in the wake of all these capitalist man-made disasters that have struck New Orleans and the people there. She cares very much about it, and we all do. And I see your point, Elizabeth, about focusing locally. Absolutely, we have to do that. But I do also believe very much that we have to look at this as not just a national but an international and a global phenomenon. But all of that said, we living in this country really do have a responsibility to communicate to the rest of the world that there's at least a section here that says American lives are not more important than other people's lives. And, you know, this country is not even able to take care of a huge percentage of the people that are living in this country. And when I say take care of, I'm talking about basic human needs of adequate nutrition, schooling, a right to live without the police hounding you all the time. Do you guys know? I mean, just think about what's happening in this country. The biggest section of people going into prison now is black women because of the whole economic situation.
Right. The
so-called war on drugs. When we think of a prisoner now, we need to think of a black woman about age 23 years old with a couple of kids. Those are the hardened criminals,
uh-huh.
you know, that this system is locking up. This is completely outrageous. So all of that needs to be fueling and understanding, fueling our understanding all the time of what we're up against. But also know, this is what I'm arguing for, that the way this system is working continually is going to call forth people to resist it and to not accept it. And we need to be there with our organizations, and I think also on a national level, saying, look, you do not have to accept this. Not only that, but we have a responsibility to do all we can in these different ways. Not everybody can do everything, but to call out what is most key. And as you and I agree, we've talked about this many times, the U.S. global war on terror and the need for the U.S. to project this military might, particularly in the Middle East, is an engine that's driving every choice that this country makes. And it's really important to have very visible presence through these drones, you know, people protesting torture, supporting Bradley Manning, supporting all the attacks on people around the world in our name in a very visible way. And that's, in general, what I call on people to do. World Can't Wait is you know, we're putting our heads together, and I know that some of our supporters are on the call tonight because I asked them to come on and help think about these questions. We should very much continue the conversation, and I think I'll leave it there because I could, obviously I'm a little and I could go on for a long time, and we should. These are the kinds of conversations we should have.
Absolutely, and we do have a little bit more time. We have a very good friend on the call, John Gold. If John, he does a lot of work for peace and for justice, and I'm going to ask him to unmute his phone and ask you a question, Deborah, *6, John Gold, or I can unmute you. Okay. John, you're unmuted, so ask Deborah your question, please. John?
Hi, Cindy. Hi. Yeah, I'm here. Hi, Cindy, Deborah, Diane. Thanks to Glenn Ford for coming on. you're talking about the war on terror, and obviously, as you know, I've been an advocate for 9/11 justice for over a decade now, and we were lied to about that day. Every investigation we got into 9/11 was compromised and corrupt. So if we were lied to about 9/11, then there is no justification for the post 9/11 world and everything that entails. And I'm hoping it's a very powerful card to play if we want these occupations to end, and you know, everything the post 9/11 world entails. If we want it to end, that's a very powerful card. And I know that 9/11 truth or 9/11 truthers have a very bad name, and it's very, it's challenging to question 9/11 because you get attacked, you get slandered, and so forth. But it's the right thing to do, in my opinion. So I hope that progressives such as yourself could at least start acknowledging that we were lied to. You don't have to say 9/11 was an inside job and all that stuff, but we were lied to. There's no justification for it. And I'm hoping that progressives start at least addressing that much. Thank you guys for your time.
You know, I really hear you, John, and I certainly agree on the basic point that there was no, there, look, they never intended to really investigate and reveal what happened. I think anybody who cares about truth, which we all should, knows that and feels that not only were we lied to about what happened on 9/11 and surrounding it, but that in fact the whole enterprise is a lie in a certain sense, that George Bush used this to create and fabricate a bunch of reasons to go into Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's been continued and untold. You know, Glenn talked about that survey being done. What if there were thousands of Iraqi lives that were lost? And I'm thinking to myself, back to 2003, how naive that sounds, doesn't it? There were a million Iraqi lives lost. A million. And it's a number too huge to contemplate. But what I think about 9/11 being the key and the trump card is it actually isn't, because all that was already in place before 9/11. I was an anti-war activist just by feature of my age, you know, for more than 45 years now, and I've seen the 9/11s be spread across the rest of the globe by the U.S. I understand that it was used in a terrible, terrible way to bring about a whole change. And in fact, this is why we actually thought we might be able to drive out the Bush regime, because the things that Bush did off of 9/11 with the sweeping national security state, which, by the way, we, you know, I think we all know, it was already in place. The Patriot Act was written. They couldn't have written it in 3 weeks. They quickly cobbled things that they had wanted for a very long time together. And yes, it could have been, I will even say, yeah, it could have been an inside job in a certain way. Certainly there was collusion. Certainly there was a way in which the Bush administration willingly closed its eyes to certain developments for political expediency. And maybe there's more to it than that. But even so, even before that, for decades and decades before, you had a huge military that they have used and have been aching to use. And the whole setup in the Middle East was in existence and in contention since the end of the Second World War, and set up the modern basis for the U.S., you know, defeating its rival, the Soviet Union, driving out the other smaller imperialist countries, even though they're still contending with them, and seeking to be the unchallengeable empire in the Middle East. That's still what we're up against. And I feel that is the driver, not the incident at the World Trade Center in 9/11. So, you know, I hope that's somewhat of a cogent response.
Well, I, you know, John Gould is a very good friend of mine, and I love him. And I agree that, you know, we were lied to about 9/11, but I always ask him, what was the justification for the pre-9/11 world? You know, did 9/11 happen because there was a pre-9/11 world, you know? So anyway, I have one more comment to read from you, and this is from Chris in Houston. She wanted me to read you this comment. And if people want to continue this conversation, like Deborah said, I think it's very important. We have a Facebook page for this community call-in. I know that one of our friends has created a Facebook page called Anti-Empire or something like that that we can send out. There wasn't an Anti-Empire Facebook page, so we can certainly continue the conversation on that page also. But I know that the conversation isn't going to stop. But pretty soon, I hope the conversation leads to some kind of mass movement and mass action. But this is a comment, Deborah, to you from Chris Graham in Houston. She says, there's no significant resistance to Barack Obama's policies. In fact, he has now been given carte blanche by the American people to do whatever in the hell he wants to. The American people seem to need a patriarchal, authoritarian father figure to tell them what to do, how to do it, and when to do it. And she says, Deborah's kidding herself if she thinks a significant number of black individuals who are incarcerated and who would vote if they were freed would not vote for Obama. Black people vote for Obama because he is a black man in the White House that black slaves built. I believe, number one, that the collective IQ of the American people has gone down significantly. And number two, the only thing real to people is hunger. And people in the United States aren't hungry enough and aren't watching their children die of starvation and preventable diseases to get off their asses and revolt against the powers that be. Nothing will change until the people are starving to death. Their children are starving to death, and they realize that the wealthiest among us have everything. She says, Chris continues, Glenn Ford is a realist and calls the situation as he sees it. I don't believe Deborah is being realistic. Deborah?
Well, you know what they say about being realistic, demand the impossible. I don't think real change comes from voting. Honestly, there's over 100 million people in this country who don't vote at all. I don't consider that a horrible problem, but I also don't think it's an indication that people have a whole lot of political sophistication either. I think people are pretty alienated and feel like there's nothing much that I'm going to be able to do, but at least they're not deluded into thinking their vote makes any difference. Part of the thing with elections, and I think this is very important to say, people in this country think that by voting, you're getting the people you're voting for to think like you think, and that somehow they're going to respond to your vote by doing what you want them to do. That couldn't be further from the truth. These elections are really a grand charade.
Right.
To get you thinking like the people who are running. In other words, the terms most people are seeing, except if they thought about Peace and Freedom Party, or in some places Jill Stein got a lot of votes, but in general people are thinking in terms of Romney or Obama. It's always the Democrat versus the Republican. There is no substantial change that's going to come. They just trade power between themselves. So, no, I was not saying that incarcerated people are going to come out of jail and vote. Really, it's a much more complex process that real social change happens when people begin to realize not only that the current situation is untenable, but there's a different way of going at it. And I really do have a lot to say about that. I wouldn't think that I'm delusional necessarily. I would think that my expectations are not hampered by just what I see right in front of me. I do think it's possible to have very big change even in a country like this. And I know that it's essential for people like Cindy, Glenn, and myself to keep putting this out on whatever public platforms we have. It is so frigging valuable and so important that Cindy, when she ran into this opposition 4 years ago, did not cave in and fold. I mean, you guys, however many people are on the call, how meaningful is it that Cindy still is out here saying, I won't accept this. There's no noble cause. And this whole thing is a sham. She could have gone back into her shell and retreated, or she could have said, yeah, okay, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, you know, they're all good people. What's her name? Who'd you run against? The Speaker of the
House. Pelosi.
You could have folded to that.
Yeah.
This is not insignificant for the potential of a movement in this country for people who say no. And Chris, I would say to you, I'd really challenge you. I think I'm not telling you be positive, look at the bright side.
Right.
I'm telling you to really look at the material reality in this country and take into account what I'm saying. 30-some percent in some cities of children already do go to bed hungry. Does that immediately give them political consciousness to change things? It certainly doesn't. But it does create the basis for which this country, which claims to be the freest country in the history of the world, you know, to be knocked off its pedestal and for millions of people to say, you know, no, it isn't. In the wake of whatever so-called natural disaster comes along, I felt this, and part of the reason I am so vehement about this is the last 10 days in New York City. When you saw that the powers that be couldn't even handle a Category 1 hurricane. You know, our friend Elaine is out on the shores of Staten Island for the last 10 days saying, FEMA, the National Guard, NYPD, what are they doing? They're standing around with guns, protecting the yacht club. They are not helping. And the only people helping are, you know, occupiers and regular people that have organized themselves to, you know, to do actual aid. You know, and people from the revolution and political groups that are, you know, all going into the housing projects and actually helping people to formulate and fight for demands that the government has to come and help. This is where the change comes from, by people immediately meeting some of these very urgent, personal, immediate situations, and then being able to put it together with what's happening internationally and opening their eyes to it's not only all wrong, but we don't have to accept it, and we can go at this in a whole other way. And I'll be glad to post some links. I have a lot of ideas to correspond with. I'm not the greatest on Facebook. We are tweeting this conversation from World Can't Wait, and I'd love to hear from people. So my address is Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, Sweet, at worldcantwait.net.
Well, I also heard, I didn't hear Glenn say that there was no, like, nothing we could do. I heard Glenn say that putting up the, you know, depending on the elected officials is the wrong thing to do. Hitting the streets is the right thing to do. And, you know, we've seen significant numbers of people hit the streets. But like you said, we didn't drive Bush out. So what are we going to do with Obama? So do your things in your local community. And, you know, whenever we can do it, let's try to create this mass movement for change. I say the change doesn't happen in the voting booth. It happens out on the streets. And, you know, just like Glenn said, nobody's making demands, but we should make demands and back those demands up with actions and consequences. And, you know, Glenn saying that, we've been saying that for a long time. And people always ask me, Cindy, what gets you out of bed every why do you keep going? Well, do you have hope? Do you think things will change? Well, if I didn't have hope, if I didn't think things would change, I wouldn't get out of bed. I have enough reason to stay in bed. But, you know, I think that saying that someone's not realistic is like the people saying, well, if you vote for Jill Stein or if you vote for Cindy Sheehan, you're not being realistic. No, we're being idealistic. And I think you know, idealism is sorely needed in this world and in this movement where we can reach for the stars but be satisfied with the moon, because if we reach for the moon, we're not even going to get out of Earth's atmosphere.
Right on to that. I think you're right. And idealistic, but on a material foundation, because we are actually understanding and explaining to people what are the underlying forces going on here.
Right.
It's not that God has willed it this way. First of all, my opinion, there is no God. But even if you think that, this is men for the most part, but it is people and classes and systems that we've, you know, been born into, and it just happened this way. It doesn't have to be this way. There's the basis to change it. And that's why I'm arguing against sort of a determinism that this is all figured out and there's not much we can do to change it. Because the
power
of consciousness is huge, and you've demonstrated that.
Well, thank you, Deborah, and thanks for being on the call. And everybody, thank you so much for coming on the call today. And this will be podcast, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. As soon as we get the link, I'll send it out. So, Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait, thank you so much for being on this special edition of Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, and let's do it again.
Yeah, we'll talk soon again, I'm sure. So, and everybody who joined, thank you so much. Okay, peace out for now.
Well, that's the show for today. I hope you learned something, and I hope you were inspired to do something, to get out into the streets. And I'd like to thank my guests, Deborah Sweet and Glenn Ford. I'd like to thank Don DeBar from Community Progressive Radio and my engineer. I'd like to thank my producer, Mikey. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. So I'm going to take the rest of the year off to finish writing my book called I Left My Marbles in San Francisco, The Scandal of Federal Electoral Politics. But we'll be back in 2013 with some more great shows, making some more great history. Cindy Sheehan Soapbox on the air and in the streets. Peace out for now. Have great holidays and a memorable new year.